This is The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Guardian Football Weekly. So as expected, it'll be Manchester United versus Newcastle United in the Carabao Cup final. It was basically done in the first leg, but apart from a couple of early scares, Martial and Fred's goals win it. Nice to see Jadon Sancho back. Also today, a bit more on the transfer window and just the extreme difference between the money spent in the Premier League compared to the rest of Europe. There's a Premier League preview. Sean Dyche against the league leaders. Also today, the police finally apologised for Hillsborough just after anyone can actually get into trouble for it. We'll chat to the good people at Mundial Magazine about Mundial Magazine. It's good and you'll probably like it. And we never got round to discussing the top 10 players in the world in 2022, which of me and Baz made the more ridiculous decisions. All that plus some excellent observations on our terrible observations yesterday. More window cleaners, peanut butter, the name Bond, Micah Richards Bond, vasectomy requests, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Paul McInnes, welcome.
Good morning, Max.
Hello, Barry Glendenning.
Hello.
Mikel says, no actual questions, just need some hot takes from JJB. What a ridiculous niche you've carved for yourself.
I love it, Brian. I love it. How you doing, mate? You all right?
I'm very good. Thank you very much. Let's start then at Old Trafford. Manchester United 2, Nottingham Forest 0. Those goals in the second half won it for United. And like, there were a couple of Forest chances early, Paul, but it was pretty straightforward as we kind of expected it would be, Paul.
Yes, Forest really had to do something early on in the game if they were going to make a fist of it, given that they were three goals down at the halfway point of the tie. And, you know, Emmanuel Dennis had a reasonably lively game, looked something like the player they had from Watford last season, had a decent chance, had one sort of blocked by Sam Surridge on the line, I think. And then there was Brennan Johnson also had a good effort, saved by Tom Heaton. But it still felt like it was within United's control. About where Korst hit the post first half. And then second half, they permed their forwards. Put Rashford on, Sancho on, Martial on. Rashford got two assists. And Martial got on the score sheet as well as Fred. So it was job done, really. I mean, I think what was notable was how seriously Ten Hag took the fixture, playing, you know, most notably Casemiro in the centre of midfield, but also bringing out Varane, who he sometimes likes to rest. Shaw was in the team. A lot of experienced heads out there who dictated Fernandes, who dictated the play, dictated the game, and, you know, showed that Den Haag, as much as Newcastle and Eddie Howe kind of, you know, feel that this is an important moment for the club and to get some silverware to kind of show that the trajectory is going in the right direction.
It was nice to see Jadon Sancho, Barry. I mean, I hadn't forgotten he existed, but it feels like, as someone who didn't watch him all the time at Dortmund, I was just aware of this great footballer and have never seen it in Manchester United shirt. And obviously this good performance won't make or break him, but it was just lovely to see him back and enjoying playing football.
Yeah, and he got a good reception from Manchester United fans. I think he's been out for 3 months. And then there was that weird decision to send him to the Netherlands to train with some specialist team. I understand he sort of had mental health issues and fitness issues, and it just seemed odd at the time. But he's back now. He's apparently playing with a smile on his face, and the fans give him a very warm reception, which will obviously do him no end of good, one imagines. But there's not a huge amount to say about the game. Manchester United were more or less in complete control, and Forest just played quite well but weren't good enough.
Yeah, I think that's... we could just move on to the Premier League. But actually, on Manchester United, Jordan, like that sort of set of wide men, if Sancho comes into form and form that he used to have, and Garnacho keeps pushing on, and either Anthony and Rashford, that is actually quite a terrifying set of four players that you will pick between two and three of. And I don't think I've forgotten anyone obvious sort of within that set. It's an excellent set of footballers.
They are. And just on Sancho, it was really good to see him back. I mean, I've mentioned before that being a South London boy myself, I'm biased, but I really want the boy to do well. He's clearly got talent. And I think if Ten Hag, who I think the rest of the league needs to start taking seriously, I think he's a brilliant manager. If he can get his hands on people like Sancho and Garnacho, I think they've got... There's two there alone, as well as Rashford and maybe one other in the summer. They've got some really terrifying wide men to kind of take on the league next season. There's no reason why Sancho in 18 months, even a year from now, can't be doing for United what, say, Saka is doing at Arsenal. So I think it's amazing. And I also agree with Paul that I thought the squad that United picked was particularly interesting, how strong they went. They may regret that down the line of the season, but I think it was a sign of taking it very, very seriously. And let's be honest, nobody outside of Nottingham or Southampton wanted any other final than Manchester United versus Newcastle.
Just put out there a potential counterpoint to the four wide men being, you know, well, obviously they're exciting and obviously, but there is a potential shadow on that, which is that you've got four very expensive players and Garnacho, whose contract is, you know, about to come to an end, well, in at the end of next season, I think, but is a very highly rated talent. That how are you going to keep all these guys happy? And you know, if you can only play two of them, that's the system they kind of play. If you've got Fernandez in the middle there, are you going to be able to keep them all happy? And furthermore, these players seem to be players who need to play to get into form. You know, Anthony being one, Sancho being another. They need regular runs of game. So actually, it might be that there's a bit of congestion there that could be problematic.
Could you do Sunday League and just guarantee them all 45? You'll all get 45. If you can be bothered to come all the way to Wembley, I'll give you all 45. That's what Ten Hag has to do. I mean, the final, Barry, is beautifully poised, right? And we talked a lot about Newcastle yesterday. Manchester United, I was surprised that it was 5 years without a trophy. It feels, everything blends into one. I just presume that United win something every 3 years. That's a long time for a Manchester United fan to have not seen their side lift something. So sounds stupid to say both teams will want to win this final, but both teams actually really will want to win this final.
Well, yeah, of course they will. No one gets to a final and then decides, can't be bothered. But 5 years is a long time for Manchester United to go without a trophy. I think they lost two finals in that time, the Europa League and something else. It's hard to call. Newcastle are ahead of them in the league. I don't think Newcastle have been playing particularly well in recent weeks. Not as well as they were before Christmas, certainly. And Manchester United are obviously hitting their stride under Erik ten Hag. I think just on very current form, I have United edging it. But I just have a feeling Newcastle's name is on this one.
Really? I mean, it is, Jordan. And I say this, and I can't remember who was in the Carabao Cup final last year, so maybe it was exciting. But I feel like normally you get to the Carabao Cup final and it's Man City and someone else, and you think, well, they don't really mind about this, so I'm not that bothered about this final. But you just, it feels like, I reckon Carabao are very happy about the teams that they have in this final.
Well, it was Chelsea-Liverpool, wasn't it, last year, I think. But yeah, this is a game where, I think as Barry says, the most interesting thing about it is that I don't know who goes in as favourites. I think on current form, United probably edge it. But I think the momentum, and I think what Newcastle are building, that makes me lean more towards them. But then I like Ten Hag, so it should be a really good final. It's good to have a team like Newcastle, who are not often in this final, but yeah, I suppose for Carabao, it's a dream, because you'll have both two teams that are desperate, as you mentioned, to take the cup home.
And I suspect, Paul, a lot of people will say, and it's hard to, and it probably does ring true, that because Manchester United have players who have won things, you know, you think of Varane and Casemiro and that kind of experience, that will help on the day, and that there is a possibility that Newcastle, just there's a sort of giddiness, right, about Newcastle. You know, Trafalgar Square will be, Fountain will be full of Newcastle fans. There will just be a sort of everybody there. None of them have really experienced a final, I don't think. And so I wonder if to controlling that giddiness will be important.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you do kind of feel that, Kieran Trippier is kind of the boiled down essence of kind of gritty, been there, seen there, done that, not a composure man. They've got players elsewhere in the team that Callum Wilson and Bruno Guimarães strike me as being quite kind of battle-hardened individuals. Nick Pope, very composed goalkeeper. So, it's down to the manager, Eddie Howe. He's a smart guy. I'm sure he will send them out with the right message. I agree with Barry, though. I think their form is slightly not what it was. And I think they're struggling for goals a little bit at the moment. That is something that might tilt the game in Manchester United's favour. But again, and as well as you might feel that the name is written in the trophy, and I can imagine that, there's also the kind of it's been such a long time since Newcastle United won a trophy that you can also feel that kind of curse extending on into onto the horizon.
I was going to quickly say that also I think how both teams go into this match I think is crucial. Newcastle have got a top four chance. As of United, do they start now changing their lineups in the league to get ready for this final? And Man United have also got the Barcelona tie, I think, the same week as the final as well. So how both teams go into this final could impact other competitions as well.
Yeah, United have pretty much two games a week up until the final, whereas Newcastle have a far less busy schedule and they have, I think, 7-day rest before it without a game.
And unless he's hosting a meet award somewhere, it's a good time to get Kevin Keegan out and into a punditry and just ask him if he would love it if Newcastle won this game. We did quite a lot on the transfer window yesterday and talked to the transfers. I just thought it was interesting to talk about the Premier League compared to the rest of Europe. Johnny Liu wrote quite an interesting piece about, you know, the sort of lunacy of the money that's spent. And Colin Miller, the journalist, writing that 31 of the most expensive 35 January transfers were made by English clubs, nought by clubs in Spain, Germany or Italy. Never has the financial gap been so great. I think Bournemouth outbid AC Milan for someone, which, you know, if you sort of told Jimbo in the 90s, that quite ridiculous. The 288 million spent by Chelsea alone was more than the combined amount spent by the Bundesliga, Serie A, La Liga and Ligue 1. And this is what Johnny was saying. Look, more of European smaller clubs, quite a few of their larger clubs, will end up sort of just refashioning themselves as talent factories for the Premier League mid-table. And I don't know if this is a bad thing, because we want there to be, it's easy to be in a Premier League bubble, and it feels like this just doesn't feel right.
Yeah, I mean, on that sort of sustainability point, you know, you listen to Javier Tebas, who runs La Liga, went on a big rant again and is always going on a big rant against the Premier League, went on one yesterday talking about it being doped. And, you know, he says, oh, our clubs are run sustainably. And, you know, the Bundesliga is run sustainably. Whether, you know, it's Serie A is coming out of a sort of a basket case period, and partly thanks to injections of American investment. So actually, to the other big leagues are maybe not as unstable and as currently threatened as you might fear. There's then a question about, well, what about the leagues underneath that? And is just supporting five big leagues, is that a problem for the whole of Europe? So there is that financial case. But I think in Johnny's piece, which is an interesting read, touches on a lot of different things. I think the point he sort of, comparison he draws is the amount of spending in the Premier League compared to the amount of spending in Disney and creating content. And it's comparable. And I think really the way you've got to look at this, and particularly with the amount of American investment going in, is that if they're building a product, that's what they're doing. They want to, it's about TV money. It's about continuing to kind of maintain the global broadcast dominance. And you'll know this, Max, as well as anybody, you know, working in Australia, the broadcast dominance of the Premier League and taking it away, getting more money, renewing those deals, extending those deals, growing the international fan base. And you do that by having compelling stars on the pitch. And I think there's also a bit of it that says quite a lot of people like watching the transfer window in and of itself as well. People, you know, that idiotic phrase, who won the transfer window. Some people do actually care about that. And that's part of the drama, part of the entertainment thing. I think if you look at it through that perspective, it becomes something slightly different.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose what's interesting is that on that specific subject, I do find it fascinating that, you know, some people, you know, your Romanos, your Ornsteins, you know, they've sort of carved a career out of knowing like 10 minutes before anyone else if Enzo Fernandez has signed it. Why don't you just wait 10 minutes? I don't, you know, like it's, you know, I would love Barry to be forced into that role, to be cracking the phones, you know, come rain or shine. It seems, it does But you're totally right. Paul is totally right that that is a that's part of the currency.
On yesterday's pod, we were talking about, you know, reasonably sane adults talking about these telephone numbers that Chelsea and other clubs were spending, as if it was just completely normal, you know. And we're living in an age of austerity. And then yesterday I put on Sky Sports News and they kept, you know, showing looped footage of Endo Fernandez's plane landing at some airport somewhere. And you just go, this is insane. What are we doing? But that's the way it is now. And people lap that shit up, you know, and good luck to them. There's nothing wrong with that, but it's just bizarre.
I try to stay away from the whole transfer madness and all the kind of the shit that goes with it as well, because it's just stupid. But I do think, I often hear people talk about the fact that, oh, football's awash this money. And as Barry said there, in a time when we're living through austerity, and my kind of brain goes to, okay, so what's the link? Why should, and I don't know the answer to this question, but why should the fact that the country is in austerity and there's people struggling in their everyday lives, why should that matter that football is, you know, a wash, you know, it's like an orgy of money going around and there's inflated money being paid for football players. What's the link? Why should the everyday man care that Enzo Fernandez has gone for a stupid amount of money in his industry when I'm struggling to pay bills for I work in the Shell garage or Tesco, wherever it may be? How do the two link?
Well, I agree with you. And I mean, you know, people make these comparisons, you know, focus on football and not on movie stars and whatever they earn. I just guess there's a vulgarity and there's a sort of this culture of waste, right? And there are all these footballers who were bought for loads of money last window and just sort of bugger off somewhere on loan for not very much money. Well, I suppose we are also part of the machine, right?
Oh, absolutely.
We're part of the if it's a problem, we're part of the problem. I wonder, Paul, if, you know, eventually, you know, is it better if you're a rich American to buy Bournemouth then to be part of this because it's got the most money? Or you could go and buy a team in France or Spain and maybe have a chance of actually being there and seeing a trophy being lifted.
Yeah, I mean, I think increasingly you're seeing the former, aren't you? The people are going, well, despite the high valuations of buying clubs in England, then, you know, you're part of the main game in town. I mean, you know, the Premier League is an international product that happens to be based in England. And there's no reason why. Well, there is one reason why Bournemouth can't become the next great international sensation, and that's the size of their ground. You know, you go to the Vitality Stadium, you're aware immediately of Bournemouth's small club history, but that could change over time. And I'm sure these owners are thinking in those terms. The live experience is an increasingly sidelined part of the football game. You need the fans in there, you need the noise, but beyond that, you know, as we saw in Qatar, you can always turn the dials to make things louder than they might appear anyway. Beyond that, it's all about what happens on the TV screen, and that can really be, or the phone screen, and that can be, happens anywhere really.
All right, well, that'll do for part one. Part two, we'll look ahead to this money-swilling, hideous beast that is the Premier League. Hi, Pod fans. Football Weekly is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted to League Two after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League One? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May the 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Yes, the money swinging beast, and we feed off the scraps, Barry. Friday is Chelsea Fulham, West London Derby. I mean, Chelsea and all the new signings. I guess the fascinating thing, Baz, we see just who gets in the Chelsea team.
Yeah. I mean, this raft of new signings have been brought in, all on long contracts. It's 8 in January. By the law of averages, you'd think at least 3 of them are going to be flops. Now, we don't know who.
Let's hope so.
Chances are, and, you know, I really hope, I would love if all 8 of them just did a Winston Bolger for the next 8 years. Well, João Félix is only on loan, but the other seven, that would be so funny. Graham Potter's gone. He's got a problem now. I mean, it's just, who does he pick? Who does he leave out? What does he do with Hakim Ziyech if he's home from Paris? I did love on Sky yesterday, they kept referring to the fact that he's stranded in Paris, as if that, like Tom Hanks in that airport.
No. Of all the Tom Hanks films you were going to pick, I'd have thought Castaway would have worked better as stranded, but you're right.
Hakim Ziyech stuck in a no man's land in an airport talking to a football with a face painted on it. If Chelsea lose this game, which is quite possible, Graham Potter's going to be under more pressure. The fans are not, a lot of the fans are not particularly happy with him. And I don't know if that huge splurge is... I'd love to know what he thinks of it. Obviously, he wants good players at his disposal, but it does ramp up the pressure on him.
Yeah. I mean, so why must I sit there, Paul, with a whiteboard, just writing with all written down, going, or maybe they're on like magnetic strips and he could just keep putting them in, going, God, I just don't know. And actually, the point you made about the Man United front four, like, how does he keep everybody happy? I've no idea.
Yeah, well, I kind of feel like what has actually happened is that they're going to bin off last summer. Like, they spent 250 million on, you know, Cucurella, Sterling, Koulibaly, etc. and so on. And I think they're all going to get binned off, because if there's any strategy to what they're doing here, and I kind of imagine there is, I think it's a risky one, but I think there is, that they're going for what they perceive to be the best international talent at the age of, average age of 23, so that they can play now, but they've also got scope to develop and they've also got resale value. And that's the logic behind Enzo Fernandez. He's the you know, the Jorginho replacement, or Kante replacement. And, you know, they're willing to pay that money for him because he's that age, that skill set, and they can build a team around him. But I think they're looking at these players who they bought previously who are 28 or, you know, a bit older, and kind of thinking, yeah, well, they haven't cut it, and B, no, that was the wrong approach. And, I think that's an indictment in and of itself when you're talking about waste. But yeah, I think you're going to see these new, I think Mudrić will start, I reckon. The fans will get to see a bit of him this weekend. You'll probably see Fernandez come off the bench. But yeah, and then place people like Noni Madueke, who, you know, is a great talent and has been developing really well at PSV. I suspect you'll see them sort of more slowly coming into the side. Although Badashieli is already in the team and playing well, isn't he?
Everton Arsenal is the early kickoff on Saturday. Richard says, what will the scenes be like in the BeIN Sports studio when Arsenal lose to Sean Dyche's Everton? Obviously, his first game, they didn't get anyone in the transfer window despite going after every footballer that exists. Why, Jordan, do I think Everton will get something from this game? There's no logic to that.
No, it's all set up, isn't it, for a Sean Dyche, if you like, masterclass of digging in, bodies on the line, off the line, balls cleared, and then nicking it in the last minute to inflict Arsenal's first defeat since, what was it, October, when United beat them. They'll be up for it. I saw some videos. I forgot to put it in the WhatsApp group. I saw a video of him doing the bleep test with the players on day one. It was so old school and Sean Dyche. I loved it. So if anything, they'll be drilled, if nothing else. I think from an Arsenal perspective, I think Arsenal got to kind of block out the noise of it being Everton's new manager's first day. They've got to treat it as business as usual. They've come through a very difficult set of fixtures in the last four or five matches. You know, they've got to see it as, this is the bottom team in the league, or bottom three team in the league. If you want to win the title, you have to win these games. So I think Arsenal, you need to kind of just see it as a get in, get the job done, get out. I don't think they need to be particularly pretty or expansive. Just get the 3 points and move on. Can I just briefly touch on Jorginho? Because I know you discussed transfers yesterday, but there was so much nonsense I heard spoken about by a core of the Arsenal fan base about this. And I accept that it's not a glamorous £100 million signing like Chelsea are doing. But I think it's a very, very low risk signing, Max. I think that if we don't win the title, it won't be because of Jorginho. But I think if we do, I think it could be because of him. I think it's a very, very intelligent, very economic signing of someone that's won things, knows the Premier League, and offers you cover. And my logic with the Jorginho thing is, It's a year and a half contract or 2 year contract. He's only got to be good for 4 months. He's only got to be good for the next 4 or 5 months. So this idea that he's like, you know, the long term, no, it's just to get us over the line. So I think despite wanting Caicedo and other players that were more glamorous and more expensive, we might actually have brought in someone that actually is probably beneficial for the now ahead of those guys that in the long term are probably better, but in the short term might not have been so good.
How do you see it going, Baz?
I think Arsenal beat them.
Oh, you're probably right.
Quite you? Comfortably.
Yeah.
Everton are an absolute mess. I don't know if a couple of bleep tests and some set piece training will sort be enough to sort them out for this one. But yeah, I mean, Everton, God, they just had such a bad disastrous transfer window, which I'd imagine has left Sean Dyche effing and jeffing under his breath, at least. I saw a couple of Everton fans on TV, from Everton Fan TV or whatever it's called, yesterday, warning more or less the board to stay away because they don't want them there as a distraction. You know, they're saying, we'll get behind the team, we'll get behind Sean Dyche, but we don't want you there because sections of the crowd will turn on you. It'll be a distraction for fans, it'll be a distraction for players. And it's a mess there at Goodison Park.
Yeah, just a tiny little point that I wanted to make. You know, this bad defending of Everton's is kind of endemic. It's been there for a long time. I mean, Rafa Benitez couldn't sort it out. So, you know, hoping that Sean Dyche can kind of, you know, neutralise that in 1 week might be a bit ambitious.
On Sean Dyche hating hats and never wearing hats, Sam did a deep dive and found a picture of Sean Dyche wearing a hard hat in 2016. So if there was going to be a hat that he would allow, it would absolutely be a hard hat, wouldn't it? Saturday, looking at the fixture list, it's sort of one of those where none of them really jump off the page to me, but they all have it's that stage of the season, but they all have something riding on them, don't they? And Villa, Leicester, Villa's run has been really impressive under Emery, winning 7 and drawing 1 and losing 1 under Unai Emery. And they play Leicester, who at the bottom of the table, Paul, is just so ludicrously tight, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Leicester's form is woeful and, you know, has been. There was this a sort of a mini renaissance before the World Cup, completely forgotten about since the return from the World Cup. And Villa are 3 points off the top 6. Emery knows what he's doing. Boubacar Kamara is purring. You know, they're getting the more out of Emi Buendia, and Ollie Watkins is back in goal form. You kind of think, you know, it could be very, very difficult for Leicester. The one thing that you kind of might think is that Maddison was kind of instrumental to that good form before the World Cup, and he's now back. And, you know, Harry Soutar is a good player. They can probably plug him straight into the middle of the defence and hope he does a job. But I think it's difficult to see beyond the home win for this.
Brentford played Southampton. Brentford unbeaten in 8, which slightly surprised me. 1-4 and drawn 4. Brighton played Bournemouth. Only City and Arsenal scored more goals than Brighton since De Zerbi took over. Manchester United, Palace drew, didn't they? These fixtures, the sort of return fixtures, were quite recent, weren't they? Palace and Man United drew at Selhurst Park quite recently. And Wolves, Liverpool. Mo Salah only 3 goals away from Robbie Fowler's record of 128 Premier League goals for Liverpool. I mean, it's a massive game for Liverpool, Baz, isn't it? Because just in this sort of terrible run.
It is a massive game, and it's a game I think they will lose. Wolves have brought in 6 new players, I think, at a cost of about 77 million. I think we'll be talking more about them later. Good signings. I don't know how many of them will play at the weekend, but both sides of Merseyside have their own problems, and it would not surprise me in the least if Liverpool lost this game.
Newcastle West Ham for the late kickoff on Saturday. Nick Pope could become the first goalkeeper to keep 7 consecutive clean sheets. He's on an amazing run, isn't he? And then on Sunday we've got Forest, Leeds and Spurs, Man City.
Sorry, did Nick Pope not just keep 9 consecutive clean sheets and then until the semi-final second leg? Is it 7 consecutive Premier League?
Premier League, yes. I was about to throw Silas under the bus, but he has written in the Premier League. Last time Forrest played Leeds in the Premier League, April 1999. It was 3-1 to Leeds. Hasselbank, Ian Hart and Alan Smith with the goals. Carlton Palmer sent off for Forrest. Actually, Jordan, feels like this could be a great game. I mean, Forrest have got... I mean, I see Keylor Navas playing for Forrest, but I, unlike the Leeds fans, I really enjoy watching Leeds and think they're unlucky every week. And you know, I think Steve Cooper, again, like on that game yesterday, he's such an impressive guy. He sounds really impressive after the game. But I just think this could be a really good game.
It could be, yeah. I mean, Forrest were dog awful, I thought, in both legs. They had a couple of chances against United in the second leg last night, but they were crap. But they're 13th in the league. So for a team that I've kind of thought is actually awful, they're not doing too bad. And to be fair to them, I remember pre-season Forest fans calling up, you know, various stations and seeing lots of fan boards, message boards, and them talking about, yeah, we're going to stay up comfortably. We're going to finish mid-table. We're going to do this and do that. I'm thinking, yeah, absolutely bananas. But to be fair to them, they're only what? They're 13th. They're only 8 points, to be fair, off mid-table. But, you know, they're comfortable right now. And I think Forest Leeds does have that kind of memories of, as you mentioned there, the kind of early to mid-90s kind of Premier League fixture. Leeds are good fun, but they're the most frustrating team to watch in the world. I can only imagine what it's like being a Leeds supporter. And they seem to like Jesse Marsh until they don't. He says something very, very nice that doesn't go down very, very well. But this should be a fun game.
I just wanted to say that, you know, I agree with you, Max, about this weekend's fixtures. I think all of them have something to say about them. And this, for me, is perhaps the most interesting game of them all with that throwback. But also sort of the inverted aspect of it. You know, Cooper is a manager that everybody trusts, is rated as being one of the, you know, the best, you know, most promising young talents in the division. Everybody's suspicious about Jesse Marsh. Forest sort of appeared. Forest have a, you know, this crazy transfer policy that meant, you know, they've got 28 players in. Leeds have bought really, really well this season. And I think had a good, you know, another good window. I think Weston McKennie is going to be a really important addition for them over the course of the season, because I think, you know, again, you can just plug him in. He understands, plays, he knows Tyler Adams really well. The two of them function really together as a team. They strengthened back. They got a clean sheet last time. I think it's a really interestingly poised fixture, which, you know, if one of them, one or t'other wins, it could really send momentum going in both directions.
And then Spurs City, 4:30 on Sunday. Antonio Conte is going to spend a bit of time away from football to recover from gallbladder surgery he had yesterday. So we wish him well. His assistant, Christian Stellini, is expected to step up. Do you think that'll make a difference, Barry?
Antonio Conte's absence. I feel rotten saying, but might improve their performance.
Might improve their first half.
I mean, my heart goes out to Conte. He's had an awful time of it in the last few months off the pitch anyway. So, you know, I hope he gets well soon. I don't think his absence will make any difference, but I'm struggling to see Spurs getting anything from this game. I suppose they're at home, but I saw their cup game against Preston, massively unimpressed. I know they won it quite easily in the end, but they were very poor against a team that isn't particularly good, but defended extremely doggedly. And Tottenham, as early as the first half, were beginning to look just bereft of ideas of how to break down this team that was assembled in front of them. And if they play like that, they'll get walloped.
And just the most kind of basic and obvious bit of contribution to the pods here. But this for City is a massive game, because if Arsenal win their game against Everton the day before, they go 8 points ahead with a game in hand. You know, Spurs aren't playing very well. I think they've been blagging the whole season, to be honest. But and I know that Spurs lost the game a couple of weeks ago at City, but they have proven to be a difficult team for City in the last few years. So this is a big game for City, especially if Arsenal win their game.
The top 100 players in the world, men's players in 2022, the top 10 was announced. Messi came first and Mbappe second. I should have gone 10 to 1, like Bruno Brooks. Mohamed Salah at 10, Thibaut Courtois at 9, Vinicius Jr. 8, Lewandowski 7, De Bruyne 6, Luka Modric 5, Haaland 4, Benzema, Mbappe, then Messi. What was your most ridiculous selection, Barry, looking back?
I think it was not so much selections as omissions. Who was the Italian fella Nikki spoke about? She said that he wasn't then playing for Napoli. Got striker playing for Napoli.
Victor Osimhen.
Yeah, left him out completely. So that was a conspicuous, glaring omission. My top 10 was Messi, Mbappe, Haaland, Modric, Lewandowski, Hakimi, Casemiro, De Bruyne, Giroud, McAllister. And looking at that now, I'm thinking Giroud, but still, he had a good season or a good year.
Yeah, I had Valverde at 5, which is perhaps a bit bold. And then Luka Modric made 24, which is weird for me because he's one of my favourite footballers of all time. Victor Osimhen plays in Italy, plays for Nigeria as well, just before anyone yells at you, Barry. Let's talk about Hillsborough, because the National Body for Police Chief Constables has issued an official apology for the police failures that led to the unlawful killing of 97 people in the Hillsborough disaster in 1989 and for the pain and suffering experienced by the bereaved families for years afterwards. Martin Hewitt, the chair of the NPCC, made the apology at the launch of a report setting out senior police officers' commitments to learn lessons from the Hillsborough failures. These include every force having assigned a charter for bereaved families in 2021 that requires police organisations to acknowledge mistakes with openness and candour after a public tragedy and not seek to defend the indefensible, as South Yorkshire Police were accused of doing after the 1989 disaster. Andy Marsh, Chief Executive of the College of Policing, the standard-setting body for the police in England and Wales, said a new code of ethics would also be issued for consultation in the next few weeks. He made an apology saying policing has profoundly failed those bereaved by the Hillsborough disaster over many years. We're sorry that the service got it so wrong. Police failures were the main cause of the tragedy and have continued to blight the lives of family members ever since. When leadership was most needed, the bereaved were often treated insensitively and the response lacked coordination and oversight. Now, on the face of it, Barry, it looks like they're saying the right things. The one really important caveat is no one can now face prosecution from the police.
Well, they admit the police failures were the main cause of the tragedy, and it's taken them 34 years to do that. But no police officer has faced any disciplinary measure or been convicted of any crime. So, you know, the victims or the bereaved families still are going, whose fault was this? You know, the police have admitted it, but nobody's been punished. Only one person has been convicted with regard to anything to do with the Hillsborough tragedy, and that was the then secretary of Sheffield Wednesday, who was found guilty of one safety offence and received a fine of less than 10 grand. So, look, the apology, it's late. It's better than nothing. But what the bereaved families want now is the introduction of this, what's called this Hillsborough Law. So James Jones, the former Bishop of Liverpool, who's previously the chair of the Hillsborough Independent Panel, he issued this report several years ago that had 25 recommendations. It was 5 years ago his report was published. And the government has yet to respond to that. And Labour's Yvette Cooper said, like, it shows a lack of respect for the victims. But this Hillsborough Law, it's a bill introduced in Parliament in 2017 by Andy Burnham. And it would make it a legal duty for public institutions to tell the truth in proceedings, investigations, and inquiries, and to act with candour and frankness, as the police have promised to do. One would imagine, you know, the police should tell the truth.
Yeah, that would go, yeah, absolutely.
And should act with candour and frankness. This shouldn't be something they've suddenly stumbled, oh, yeah, maybe we should tell the truth. And the thing is, when there are inquiries into disasters like Hillsborough or Grenfell, you've got Joe Public up against public institutions or the government, and they're much better resourced, they deflect, they lie, they obfuscate, they drag out legal proceedings. And this all adds to the suffering of the bereaved families, who also don't have anywhere near the same resources to pay for lawyers and stuff like that.
Yeah. And actually, they just don't know where to start, right? They just don't know, where do you go? Like, what building do you go into? Who do you call? All these really basic things. Yeah.
And lots of obstacles are placed in their way. If this bill introduced by Burnham becomes law, it will make it a more even playing field for bereaved families who are trying to get answers in the wake of tragedies. But yeah, I just can't get over the fact that the police, 34 years after Hillsborough, have signed a charter promising to be more truthful and not engage in cover-ups.
Yeah. Ian Herbert in the Mail wrote a piece actually saying that, and you know, about the report. Just one line really struck with me, saying, look, the report did not include what he said were the nasty little details of what those failures looked like. For example, the deliberate distortion of junior officers' evidence, which saw 164 statements substantially altered, comments unfavourable to the constabulary removed or changed in 116. You know, if you're going to own up to this, like, put everything out there. But anyway, that'll do for part two. Part three, James Bird, the feature editor of Monday El Mag, will join us and we will talk about it. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. We're going to talk about Mundial magazine. You may have read it. You may have a subscription. You may not have a clue what it is. James Bird is a feature editor there. Thanks for coming on, James.
I'm really pleased to be here. Yeah, I've got a 10-month-old daughter who's just brought the plague back from nursery. So if I keel over halfway through, just carry on. I'll be fine.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, an ill baby. I have a 10-month-old boy. And we could talk. I mean, honestly, how are they sleep? Are they sleeping okay?
No.
How's that going?
No. No sleep.
Oh, mate. Oh dear. Yeah, we think we've vaguely solved it. Not interesting anyway. And look, Josh Widdicombe and Rob Beckett, a very successful podcast where this would really be great content. Tell us what Mundial magazine is, please. For that, you just released issue 24, but for, you know, listeners all over the world who might not know about it, tell us about it.
So, Mundial started in 2014. It was initially a one-off magazine to celebrate the World Cup, but it did really well. So we carried on, and we're now a quarterly printed publication. Comes out every 3 months, supposed to remind people why they love football. So I think it's interesting stories, bold design, nice photos, and it's not just about the game on the pitch, it's about everything that surrounds it. So travel, fans, food, clothes, boots. And I think we do the sort of, we put as much effort into long form features as we do short form features. So there might be a long form piece about Diego Maradona at Argentinos Juniors, and there might be a long form piece about a team from the lower tiers of the Welsh Football League. There might be a piece about Christy the Pie, the Wigan mascot, or there might be a list about the most chaotic teams of all time. So we try to treat the game democratically, I guess. And you can read the whole magazine without knowing who's top of the Premier League, without knowing which managers are under pressure. That everything that exists in the magazine is supposed to be timeless, so you can pick it up at any point and go through it and enjoy it. That's what we try to do.
At the risk of unleashing a spoiler, I would like to take exception to the fact that in your forthcoming issue, the Wigan mascot was given a threat level of 0 out of 10 because he's a pie. I think he looks quite sinister.
He does look quite sinister, but we didn't want to pigeonhole pies as sinister. I think that's fair.
I think that's a very balanced view. I mean, would you say, I mean, obviously I grew up with Shoot and Match, and that was very much, you know, that was league ladders and just posters of football. You know, it was just like, here's a picture of John Ebrill, and then, you know, and then Match ratings out of 10 for Scunthorpe. And why was I reading that? But I was. This is a more cerebral concept. I mean, it's the hipster's choice, right? It's a football hipster's choice. There is a recommendation for 2020-21 FC Utrecht training shorts in this issue.
They're a good pair of shorts.
Yeah, they're nice.
I think it's fair to say that as the hipster choice. And we play with that as well. We'll definitely say we're the magazine for the flat white drinking tote bag carrying football fan. But I think at the same time, we're also silly. We love Match. We love Shoot. We love sort of like the early loaded magazines where it was all sex and drugs and fun stuff. So I think definitely sort of, yeah, cerebral maybe. And we try to maybe pretend we're intellectual, but I think we're as silly as any good magazine should be.
Are you guys old enough to have grown up in a culture of magazines, or is this something that you there's a nostalgia to it a little bit? Because I may be wrong here, but I think you went out of print publication for a bit, but then came back. So you're obviously very committed to the format in an age when not many people are.
Yeah, I mean, we're all aged between, I mean, we're now all aged between 30 and 45. So there's definitely an element to having rose-tinted glasses and looking at magazines through a sort of nostalgic lens. But also, we all love the idea of having something physical and having something that you can hold and look through and smell and sort of show off to your friends and family that you've got this thing that looks quite nice in your bag or on your coffee table. Let's be honest, it's good to have something that you don't need Wi-Fi for or the battery can't run out of. It's quite good to get away from the doom scroll because we all do it all day, every day. And it's quite nice to be producing something that's away from that.
Hi, James. You mentioned that the magazine is a democracy and there's a wide breadth of different subjects that you cover in the magazine. What was the idea for a feature that you all thought, we really want to do this, but we're not quite sure if it will land, that actually ended up doing pretty well?
That's interesting. I think the bravest feature that we've done since we came back. So during the pandemic, we didn't release a magazine for 2 years. It just wasn't feasible. We were all working from our kitchens and we weren't sure if we were going to be able to carry on. But we've got through that. And I think in the first magazine after the pandemic, we did a really bold feature that was a report from the front line of Ukraine that was done by a guy called Jake Hanrahan, who runs a independent conflict journalism brand called Popular Front. And he went to the Ukrainian front line and spoke to a bunch of guys who used to be ultras, who used to be sort of hooligan fighting ultras, who are now fighting on the front line of Ukraine. And I think that was one where we had to sort of go, is this the right thing to do? But then realise absolutely, yes, it was. And it was a really, really special piece of writing and the kind of thing we definitely want to do more of, where something's brave and different. And, you know, football wasn't really mentioned throughout the whole piece, but it's still part of football culture because of who they were.
Yeah, I mean, I think we wrestle with that, those similar balances of I essentially want to be silly all the time, but fine, because if you try and cover football and all of football, there's a lot of murky shit that you have to cover.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, that's a big part. Our tagline is reminding you why you love football. So to sort of get around the murky stuff, not get around it, but there's so much. If you go into every football club on the planet, there's stuff that stinks. Every league, every tournament, there's stuff that stinks. And I think Mundial's always been quite forthright with its political views as well. We've always put that at the front of our communications and we've really wanted to let people know what we think about things. But equally, we want to look at the things that are at the root of football that we all enjoy. And that's the silliness, the brilliance, the magic, the adventures you have when you go and watch a game, the carnage on the way home. I hope we do that and I hope that comes across.
Give us a couple of things that are in this issue that will force every one of our listeners to go and buy it immediately.
Okay, so the cover, there's five cover stories. We did five covers, which was probably silly, but it looks nice. Five covers that we've got Rooney, Messi, Ronaldo, Maradona and Haaland. So for each of these stories, we commissioned a writer to encapsulate a chapter in the early part of their career. So Messi at La Masia, Maradona at Argentinos Juniors, Rooney in 2004 when he was the best player, the best young player in the world, Ronaldo at Cruzeiro and Haaland at Dortmund. So that's really special. I think they're five brilliant pieces. We've also got a piece about a guy who played 120 years on Football Manager, which ends up with Romelu Lukaku winning the Champions League as PSG manager 6 times and Eric Lamela winning the Ballon d'Or and Manchester City Stadium being renamed the Mancini Arena. So that's good. There's a travel piece from Iceland, which is all about sulfuric gases and how when you go to watch low league football anywhere in the world, there's still people telling each other to fuck off, which is great. And there's a really very Mundial. Barry, you mentioned us being hipsters, and
excuse me, I did not say anything about hipsters. That was Max.
That was me.
That was Max. Me.
Was it? Jesus, I'm projecting there, aren't I?
Yeah, you are.
Barry was definitely thinking it, but you know.
No, I think the Blizzard is the hipster magazine of choice. Right. I wouldn't put Mundial in the same bracket.
Fair enough.
Okay. We move forward. There's a great piece about a guy who's got an amazing Italian 19 memorabilia collection. He's got like the Fiat Panda that they made that's got the mascot all over it, and it's got seats with it's stitched into it, Coke cans and typewriters and the lot, which is frankly insane, but it's a nice piece about a man who's obsessed with something.
If somebody wants a copy, how do they get one, please?
So mundialmag.com, you can subscribe, which in the UK is only £10 every 3 months, and you get the magazine through your door. You get a Club Mundial membership card. You get access to events. I would say subscribing is a good way of getting the magazine.
All right. You're our Wolves fan, so 1 minute on how you're feeling about Julen Lopetegui.
I am a Wolves fan. Julen Lopetegui, he's definitely better than Bruno Lage. I think the Premier League is bloated and silly, and even the teams at the bottom have got players and managers that could be a top four player or manager in another league. But I think Wolves will be fine. We've got loads of players with very special attributes. Adama Traore can do things nobody else can do in the world. Neves is probably the best passer I've ever seen at the Molineux. Cadence is like a little magician. I can imagine him like clicking his fingers at some point and the ball will disappear for 5 seconds. So I think if Lopetegui gets him rolling, we'll be all right.
You don't have a player who has the specific attribute of scoring goals on a regular basis.
I know. It's bad, isn't it? It's bad. And my dad has been a season ticket holder for 50 years, and he's also been ringing up BBC WM for 50 years on the midweek phone-ins. And he recently sent me a text that said, "Jamie, we need 25 goals to stay up this season. And I've listed every player in the squad and how many goals that I think they're going to score." And it was like, Pedence, 2. Totti, 0. Jimenez, 1. Sarabia, 1. And to be fair, he did ring up WM and go through the list. And they listened to him. So
good. That's brilliant.
It's brilliant, and maybe why I'm here now.
Probably. Well, listen, thanks so much for coming on. We encourage everyone to buy the magazine because it is good and it looks great. And as you say, it's nice to not doom scroll for at least 5 minutes of your day. Cheers, James.
Thank you very much, guys. Enjoyed that. Thanks.
Cheers. James Bird there, editor, feature editor of Mundial Mag. Let's move on to any other business. Jamie says, your Turkish Super League mentioned on the last pod led me to check out the top scorers this season. Quite a trip down memory lane. Fabio Barini, inexplicably still only 31, has an impressive 14 goals. Maybe he's the striker Chelsea need. Bring him home. Christian says, with the 55-year-old Japanese striker Kazuyoshi Miura joining Portuguese second-tier side Olivense on loan, where in Europe would the panel reckon they could still do a job in the second division? Nick says, I'm really liking Barry guessing where random players are. Does he know where Ander Herrera is now?
Oh. Ander Herrera... No, I'm going to say Beşiktaş.
Now, Mario says, Ander Herrera has just moved to Athletic Bilbao. I've only now realised he's been there the entire season on a loan basis. Did Barry know of this transfer? No. On the subject of Michael Richards being James Bond, Brett says, if and when the Michael Richards Bond film happens, surely Infantino is a shoe-in for Blofeld. He has a very good shout, isn't it? Also, Richard Keys would be an excellent odd job, wouldn't he? Turner Cording on yesterday's pod, when Max was trying to remember who Jan Begnarek played for, my mouth fell open waiting for someone to bring up the fact that he started and played the full 90 for Southampton last night in the first game covered in the podcast. On a similar line, David said, on the topic of no one knowing Birmingham Blackburn was on last night, Max proved this once again 2 minutes after mentioning the game by reading out the draw for the FA Cup and saying Leicester would play Birmingham or Blackburn in round five. Neil says, on the subject of Football Weekly being listened to during uncomfortable situations, a recent Ultra Demo interview credits the pod as a welcome distraction during his victory at the 268-mile The Spine race. Ultra Demo, I should check who he is, shouldn't I? He didn't have a vasectomy while doing it, just to point that out. He is a ultra marathon runner. Damien Hall, he is, who won a race that was 268 miles long. It's an utterly ridiculous thing to do. And Dom says, as a man in his mid-30s with enough children, a vasectomy is on the cards. I would happily purchase a special medical issue pod, 2 hours of rambling to get through whatever is being sliced or diced for charity for Barry. Pick your good cause. So I'm going to do it for free. Do you want to do a vasectomy special, Barry, at some point?
I'm happy to do so if it helps gentlemen get through what sounds like an unpleasant procedure. I know a few mates of mine have had them, and yeah, sort of pushing their testicles around in a wheelbarrow for a couple of days afterwards, I think. Is it something you'd consider, Max?
Well, not today. I mean, I don't feel like I want any more children. Not that I don't love Ian Rushton, but I'm not doing it today.
Okay.
And when I do it, I will certainly not be listening to this podcast. That is for sure. Anyway, look, that'll do for today. Thanks so much, Jordan.
Cheers, pal.
Thank you, Paul.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Barry.
Thanks.
Football Weekly was produced by Silas Gray. Our executive producer is Max Sanderson. We'll be back on Monday.
This is The Guardian.